Hello, this is Leslie Garfo-Tenzer, and this is Legal Tenzer, casual conversations on noteworthy legal topics. On March 13th, an overwhelming number of members of the House of Representatives voted in favor of a bill that would force ByteDance, a Chinese internet company, to sell its social media app TikTok. Today, Eric Goldman, the foremost authority on internet law, is here to explain the bill, its implications, and the likelihood of its success. Thank you, as always, Eric, for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
So let's start at the beginning. You know, everyone says this bill means that we can't have TikTok in America. Some say it just means they have to sell TikTok. What is it really doing?
The bill is structured as a divestment bill. It says that TikTok can simply sell its ownership and then it would have the right to continue being available in the U.S. market. Should it choose not to do so, then it wouldn't be eligible to remain in the U.S. market. But that kind of conditioning is, I think, just an illusion. It's just a way of really distracting from the core issues. What Congress said is that we are kicking TikTok out of the industry here in the U.S. unless they do exactly what we tell them to do. And that's why I think the proposal is so problematic. It sounds like the kind of thing that Congress normally wouldn't have the right to do.
Yeah, and you know, but why not? Why can't we regulate how foreign companies operate in our country?
Well, we can, and there are many places in which we do so. For example, there are restrictions on foreign investments in the United States, and it's particular with respect to the media, there are restrictions on foreign ownership of broadcasting companies that are regulated by the FCC, with a concern that foreign enterprises might misuse their ownership of those media channels in order to advance interests that are not in the interests of the American people. But I think this is different in a few important ways. But let's start with, first of all, what's different from TikTok than, say, media broadcasters or just general stocks. And that's that TikTok allows people to talk to each other. So it isn't just promulgating its own media viewpoint, but it's allowing these conversations to take place organically. And so what Congress is doing is basically nixing the speech venue and saying those conversations cannot take place there. And so that is problematic in my mind, because it's not just about TikTok, it's about the people using TikTok. But the other concern that I'd flag is that back in 1997, a Supreme Court case said, whatever rules might be appropriate for broadcasting and telephony don't extend to the internet. The internet is a qualitatively different media enterprise. And as a result, what intrusive regulatory options are available for broadcasting don't apply to the internet. So the fact that there's foreign regulation of broadcasters, a regulation of foreign ownership of broadcasters, actually doesn't extend to treating TikTok equivalently.
So, you know, you talk about people talking to each other. One of the things that I saw was a big protest by people who are engaged in commerce. And they're complaining that if this bill comes to fruition, that it's going to ruin their livelihoods. Does that have any legal implications?
It might. The fact that people's jobs might be at risk aren't inherently a constitutional problem. That is natural in any regulation, that it creates some winners and creates some losers. So that alone doesn't dictate it. But I think there are two main issues here. One is that the law is directed at these nefarious Chinese activities, whatever those are, however serious they might be, but it has real world impact here in the United States for U.S. entrepreneurs. That makes it potentially bad policy, but it also undermines the justifications and rationales behind why Congress is intervening in the first place. It's saying, you know, this is a Chinese problem, but it's actually an American problem. And that's something that I think a court could consider as part of doing its consultative review. What's the regulatory objective? How well do they advance it? But I think the better approach is to think about these commercial activities that might be in play as really just forms of speech of people talking to each other. Now, some of them might be commercial speech subject to a less vigorous protection under the Constitution, but they're still subject to vigorous protection. But lots of things that we might consider to be brands and influencers talking about commercial activities, actually not commercial speech, it's actually standard, fully protected, constitutionally protected speech. And so from that perspective, I think when Congress is vetoing a speech venue, they're vetoing all the conversations that are taking place in there, some of which might be purely commercial, many of which have commercial aspects, and many of which are contributing to various forms of self-actualization, whether that's profit-making or other forms of self-expression.
So, you know, you talk about the goal and the whole idea of China. And I thought this was interesting because it really was a bipartisan vote. I mean, except for kind of the far, far right, from what I understand, everyone pretty much voted for this. Why do you think the Democrats and the Republicans were able to come together to pass this bill?
Just to clarify, actually, so it's actually surprising anyone voted against this bill. When the bill went through the House Commerce Committee, it passed unanimously. There was a Republican and Democrat supported bill. And then a couple of things started pushing back on the bill when it got to the full House floor. First, Trump came out against the bill, which I think pulled off some of the
Marjorie Taylor Greene voted against it. Yeah.
loyal fans of Trump to follow his dictates. But actually, the bulk of the people voting no were Democrats. And I think there was a variety of different concerns that relate to speech and moral authority and privacy concerns and how we're protecting them and whether or not this bill even makes sense. Like, so, you know, I think there were just some Democrats who looked at this like, I don't know what Congress is doing, but I can't support that. And so the fact there was any opposition, actually, I think was remarkable because of the fact that really what's driving this is just the political payoffs that come from politicians advancing several different narratives simultaneously. They're advancing the anti-China narrative, which is very popular. There's a lot of skepticism about the Chinese government and what it's trying to do and how it might affect U.S. interests. And so taking an anti-China perspective is a political win. There's skepticism about big tech generally. Now, TikTok is both big tech and not the normal suspects when it comes to talking about big tech. But technology regulation is very, very popular up and down the board, political, across all partisan lines. Democrats, Republicans are finding lots of political gold and standing tough against technology. And then the third issue is that it's been framed as a privacy issue, that China is snooping on us. And so to the extent that the politicians are able to send a message that they're anti-snooping, this is a low-hanging fruit win for them as well. So the fact that anyone voted against this, when that leaves them vulnerable to being argued, maybe you're pro-China, maybe you actually are in the pocket of big tech, or maybe you are not interested in protecting our privacy. All of those narratives were exposed to anyone opposing the bill. That's why bills like this goes forward so rapidly.
So I have two follow-ups for you. One is, why did Trump oppose it? And the other is, why am I reading that the Senate is likely to drag their feet on it?
So it's very hard to apply a law professor's logic to a Trump move because he's playing a different game than I play as a law professor. And often when subject to critical scrutiny, the positions don't make sense. And of course, they iterate all the time. Trump led the effort to try to ban TikTok here in the United States when he was in office. And now all of a sudden he's saying it's a bad idea. So there's an inherent hypocrisy or internal tension. His stated rationale is that if we ban TikTok, Facebook will benefit, and he hates Facebook. And right. I don't know how else to justify it because that logic is not really subject to much credence in my book. So, but the Senate is a little bit more complicated because of the fact that Senate floor time is one of the most valuable commodities in DC. It's just hard to get any time where you get a vote from the Senate. And so there's always some consideration, is this worth taking up this very valuable, scarce resource? But it's my projection that were the vote to be held, the bill would pass by a substantial margin. It's not that there's going to be strong opposition. It's really more like a logistics question. Are the Senate leaders prepared to go ahead and take the valuable floor time? I think some of the Senate leaders also share some of the qualms about the bill that I mentioned before that led to some of the people in the House voting no. You know, what is this bill doing? This bill sure sounds like a constitutional violation. We're now enacting a bill that Trump was favoring back when he was in office. Have we turned into Trumpists? There's lots of reasons for the Senate to slow down, but it's really just a question, will they schedule for a vote or not? If they do, my guess, it passes handily. It goes to Biden, he signs it, and then it goes to the courts.
That's so interesting. So if it passes, what it specifically does is it asks this Chinese internet company to sell to an American entity, right? So What's to keep them from just selling it to some kind of shell company or something like that? And, you know, would that accomplish any goals?
Yeah, so the bill does talk about, you know, the legitimacy of a potential buyer. And basically, if they have 20% or more ownership by entities that are in these things called foreign adversary countries, then it's still a problem. So from my perspective, I don't think it would be easy to game the system, but it's possible. And that's, I think, a general problem with trying to do things like carving up ownership of enterprises. There's a variety of ways in which you can use corporate governance tricks or other combinations and divisions of organizations to get around rules. But to me, I think the idea is really what I think the most likely outcome is that if there's any interest in trying to comply with law, then TikTok would sell to some American group of investors at a discount. And this is just basically a wealth transfer from the current owners of the asset to American buyers who basically get the forced sale at a lower price. So, again, Trump tried all of this back in his day. There was a whole effort to try and put TikTok in the hands of some of Trump's best buds. And that never quite materialized, but it could very well materialize this time if that's the way that TikTok wants to play it. I think the more likely scenario is that they're going to challenge it in court and hope that they can strike it down, and then the bill will do nothing.
Yeah, and I mean, the enforcement of this bill just seems kind of overwhelming to me too, on some level.
And I'm sorry, just to point out about that, we're focusing on TikTok because it's expressly named in the bill. But in order to avoid targeting TikTok uniquely, the bill covers other types of social media that might have some foreign ownership interest in by investors in these foreign adversarial countries. And so one of the many problems with the bill is that we don't even know who could potentially be subject to it and what kinds of implications that might have for the internet, for retaliation by people in other countries, by the ability of us as Americans to talk to each other. There's so many potential implications. And so we focus on TikTok, but really this bill does a lot more, and nobody is really talking about that and really appreciates just how far the bill could reach.
That's interesting. And have a chilling effect on future, development, I assume, too, in some ways, outside of the United States.
Yeah, I mean, I think the more likely scenario isn't necessarily that it would inhibit somebody from launching a social media in a foreign country and then import it to the U.S. That is a possible outcome. The more likely scenario is that we'll just see rampant retaliation. That's what happens in trade wars. If we're sticking to China, guess what? They're going to stick it right back to us.
Yeah.
And we're back into these things where every country and its constituents end up worse off from trade wars. And this is a really well-known problem. And I think one of the justifications is, well, China has kicked out our companies from our country at various times before and done exactly what this is doing, to which the answer is, well, are we adopting Chinese policies? I thought the policies were the things that we were opposing. So if we're embracing them, what's the problem? Are we trying to be more like China or not?
Right. So while I have you, I'm going to switch gears on you. Florida, Ron DeSantis passed his bill that banned children under 14 from having social media accounts. All right. So two questions on that. One is, what's the odds of that surviving legal scrutiny? And the other is, again, an enforceability issue. What's to keep, me from handing my phone secretly to my 12-year-old to keep her quiet? I don't have a 12-year-old, but.
Yeah, once again, it's so hard to apply a law professor's logic to what's taking place in Florida, because so many of the bills that are being passed in Florida are what we normally would have called messaging bills. These are bills that are not intended to be serious proposals. They're not intended to be enacted. They are purely designed to signal to voters that the politicians care about the same interests that they do. And so messaging bills look really weird and get a lot of mockery by people who are not part of the target audience because they make no sense.
Right.
And right now, Florida is fighting a legal challenge to one of its prior bills that's pending with the Supreme Court, where the answer is going to come out in months. And the answers could very well make it impossible for Florida to do what it just passed recently. And so the idea is that Florida if they were acting rationally and logically, would likely have waited a few months to get more information from the Supreme Court and then try to figure out a way to pass a bill that was constitutional. They didn't even try. They're not even trying to pass constitutional bills. They don't care because they're messaging bills. And Ron DeSantis does a big press release saying, hey, I'm fighting for our kids. The Florida legislature sends out their messages to their voters. We're fighting for the kids. They don't even care what happens in the courts thereafter because they've gotten all the political payoff and they'll not be held accountable if they pass unconstitutional laws. So we will have a Supreme Court opinion in the next X years. And I don't know what X is, but it's certainly less than 10 and probably less than 5 that will address whether or not the legislatures can pass laws that require online services to engage in age authentication. This is not a new question. Congress passed 2 laws requiring age authentication back in 1996 and 1998. Both of them were struck down as unconstitutional. And so the prevailing law for the last 25 years has been you cannot require age authentication online. That's not constitutionally permissible. And legislatures have just said, we don't care. We're doing messaging bills. So take it to the courts. And that's what's going to happen with this bill. And we'll see. You know, if we apply the laws that exist the last 25 years, this is not a closed question. What Florida did was unconstitutional. They know it and they don't care. But if they're able to make a sale at the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court says, you know, we're changing our precedent like we've done with lots of other longstanding precedent, yeah, then maybe this bill is going to become newly constitutional in a way that will rock the internet.
You know, it's interesting. I never thought of them in terms of messaging bills. I never thought that an entire legislature and governor would take the time to pass a bill just to make a messaging bill, because it seems that it's inconsequential to the extent that it has no teeth, but it's a lot of effort to get a bill signed. I guess not in Florida, you know, if everyone's on your side. But the other thing I just wanted to, that you touched on was age authentication. The New York Times had an article recently about parents using their children as influencers. So in other words, you can't be on Instagram if you are less than a certain age. So what's happening is that parents are signing up and it's the parents' account for a young person. So like there's one kid who's like a designer and he's 7 and the parents are running the account, but the kid is still an influencer, you know, and is still subject to social media. So I guess I'm looking at the end run around anything, you know, the analogy is the end run around the DeSantis bill if it passes.
I haven't even figured out all the different ways it's gamed. Again, no one really cares if it's gameable. And in the end, if it's struck down as unconstitutional, as prevailing law would dictate, then mm-hmm. we don't need to get into, you know, how could it be gamed. But I want to go back to something you said. Like, it didn't even occur to you that legislatures would waste their time on messaging bills. And frankly, what's really interesting is in a place like Florida, that's all they're doing. They're only passing messaging bills. And what I find so dispiriting about our Republican democracy is that the legislature fails its constituents when it focuses on messaging bills as opposed to actually trying to improve yeah. its constituents' lives. And then people are upset with the state of play that has not been approved by the legislature. And then that's a reason to continue supporting the existing legislature. And that's like the disconnect. Like, Florida is creating real problems for itself with the ways in which it's structuring its governance. And Floridians keep electing the exact same people, do the exact same thing right, that isn't right. working from an outsider's perspective. Right. And so, you know, like this is like a downward spiral type of problem. You know, if our legislatures aren't actually taking our constituents' interests seriously and not doing things to benefit them, and that becomes a reason to, you know, have further grievance politics, that's all we're going to get. And we're always going to have a reason to have grievances.
Yeah, I mean, I went to the University of Florida. I'm a Florida Gator. So I'm watching the educational system and all the, you know, the anti-DAI and all of that stuff. But again, Jing in some ways, and then, you know, in some ways it's surviving and I'm also a New Yorker watching everyone move to Florida, which boggles my mind. But that is commentary. Right.
The question would be, would you go back to the University of Florida? And I know that because my daughter's of college age, we're having this discussion. Right. What does she need from a college? Right. And what messages is the college and the state sending to students about whether or not it's a safe haven for them?
Yeah. I mean, safe, yes. But also, there's a whole other issue with SAFE, which we won't, that's another discussion. But I'm also thinking about just the discourse of liberal ideas. You know, Jonathan Haidt is now in the news because he just wrote The Anxious, I forgot the name of the title, the new book on it. And his prior book was about coddling and how students are coddled, and we've created a group of coddled students. And I think he pins it to higher education. And I think higher education plays an even more important role in raising the future leaders of our society than just teaching them, you know, about history and all of that stuff. So I don't know. I don't know the answer. But I would not want to send a kid to University of Florida right now.
Yeah, what we do know is that politics is dictating the kinds of conversations that are taking place in higher education circles in ways that I think aren't going to be healthy to the long-term discourse. And that's really heartbreaking. And something obviously you and I take for granted because we have benefited from the ability to express ourselves freely for so long. And many of our colleagues in states that are cracking down are not going to have the same freedoms that you and I have enjoyed and are likely to continue enjoying.
And that's the irony, because that's the beauty of tenure, right? The reason they created tenure in the first place was to allow teachers to say things that were, you know, not popular opinion and know that their job would not be taken away, to give them these free speech rights. And then you're watching places regulate what you can teach, where you can teach, and how you can teach it.
And conditioning tenure, which is the thing that really seems to drive away, you know, the top talent. If I were, you know, on the market looking for positions and there was an institution that said, we're going to do a post-tenure review that's based on subjective criteria that's subject to political valences, I'm like, no, that's not going to give me the certainty I need to do what I need to do.
Very good. Very true. And very good point. And good place to end. So thank you very much. This has been really interesting, as always. And I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me. Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
So there you have it. Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you have a topic you'd like us to discuss, or a professor or attorney with whom you'd like me to speak, send us an email at legaltenzer@westacademic.com and send us any suggestions you may have. We love getting feedback. Have a great day. This podcast was created in collaboration with West Academic. Additional episodes can be found on West Academic Study Aids Collection. Students may already have access through their school subscription and can check with their law school library for access. For a limited time, Legal Tenzer listeners can save 15% on titles on the West Academic Store with the promo code TENZER15 at checkout.